under Gustavus Adolphus in previous centuries they were. We don't think of Japan today, most of us, as a very violent place, though in the first half of the 20th century they were extremely aggressive.
Yeah,
in,
very imperialistic.
Their neighborhood. Right. So it's not human nature we're talking about. We have to think about there being a couple sides to human nature, the potentially aggressive, as you said, the hot side, the immediate reaction, but also most of our effort, you know, in our daily life is about nurturing and caring and providing for our family. And we use military force when we think that we're threatened, right? But we also use it when we subscribe to certain militarist or militarized beliefs that force works, it's effective, that it's efficient, it's not going to cost us as much as it might, it's our only alternative, or that it's natural. And none of those beliefs are actually grounded in deep evidence. We have lots of evidence to show that war doesn't work many times. It's hardly ever efficient. It's usually not the only alternative.
I got to let you know, Nita, I just looked up and saw that we're at the end of our time.
Okay.
So that's a very good point you were ending on, though. And I want to thank you very much. We've been speaking with Nita Crawford. She's with the Watson Institute of International and Public Affairs and their Cost of War project. You can Google that. You can also look at our schedule today. It had information about this on it. I want to thank you so much. Obviously, we could talk longer and more and in depth, and people should go to your page to have your information. You know, we can build our anti-war movement if we want to, and we're going to just have to do it. But I think information like your website is very useful for that. And this has been Linda Olson Osterlund for Political Perspectives, and I want to thank all of you listeners and all of you callers, and also Tammy Dean for being our engineer today.
Thanks, Tammy.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the second annual Know Your City Gala, Untold Stories, on Thursday, November 16th at 5:30 p.m. at the EcoTrust Event Space in Portland. Untold Stories is Know Your City's second annual benefit gala, and it raises essential funds to further Know Your City's programs of engaging everyday Oregonians in the history, culture, and civics of the region. This year's gala will bring together over 150 guests for an unforgettable evening, including hors d'oeuvres, drinks, dessert, performances from local talent, and a paddle raise. Again, that's the second annual Know Your City Gala, Untold Stories, on Thursday, November 16th at 5:30 p.m. at the EcoTrust Event Space, 721 Northwest 9th Avenue, Suite 200 in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Portland.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Wednesday, November 15th, 2017, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio, your sanctuary radio, your resistance radio, your whistleblower radio, and of course your fake news radio at 90.7 FM on the air and KBOO.FM everywhere. First, a little regional weather, rain, of course, highs near 50, and it is supposed to be a bit breezy, 11 to 15, gusting up to 24 miles per hour. For tonight, showers continuing with a low around 44, wind dropping off a bit. For tomorrow, Thursday, showers at a high around 49, and for tomorrow night, 50-50 regarding rain and a low around 43. Here's a quote for you from Christopher Hitchens. "The palace and the mob may superficially make natural allies. Elitism and populism are not as antithetical to some as some people believe. There you go, straight from the hitch. And here's something even grimmer to keep you rummaging through the kitchen cabinets at 4 a.m. looking for the bourbon. Xi Jinping actually sent, immediately after meeting with Donald Trump, where he treated the Trump to exactly what the Trump loves, just laps up. Oh, I could make... Well, we won't run with that one because... And Xi Jinping, though, sent an emissary to North Korea to talk it out, right, over the table, with the bourbon, probably. We don't know, of course, what was said, but the very fact that after this absurdity of greeting and meeting with Donald Trump, immediately he got on it. He sent someone to North Korea right away. This never happens. Usually, even meeting with the heads of state from other countries who actually behave themselves and act as statesmen, Chinese response is generally pretty low-key and not actually noticeable for a while after the meeting. But this immediately, which would be, I would guess, a bellwether of the seriousness of the nuclear threat. Donald Trump clearly doesn't take it very seriously, so he's made it clear that he's more interested in trade. But I don't know, trading nuclear warheads seems to be more the direction that Trump is taking the country, because right here back home, the discussion is on, is, are we able to stop him? What if he wakes up and instead of pushing the tweeter button, he pushes a nuker button? It could happen. It really could. We think it could. But it can't happen here. And another thing that's happening here, and why it is so very, very important considering the threats that are out there right now, is the fact that that protest and journalism hand in hand are rapidly being criminalized. And I do mean rapidly. We are sitting back. For whatever reason, we call it apathy, call it whatever you want, call it the best television anybody's ever seen, but whatever it is, no one is responding to the fact that protests and journalism, well, not no one, but not enough, very few, surprisingly few people are concerned about protests and journalism. One person who is concerned and is joining us this morning to talk about is Chip Givens with is joining us to talk about exactly what this might mean for all of us. It's not a pretty picture when you see your rights, and particularly your right to protest and the right of the press to speak truth to power, when these are being eroded away before our very eyes. Good morning, Chip. Thanks so much for being with us at rather short notice this morning.
Thank you for having me.
So we see in the New York, no less than the New York Times, a piece, journalism swept up in Inauguration Day arrest, faces trial, the executive director, given to yourself as a legislative and policy counsel with the group Defending Rights and Dissent, and putting out a recent statement, political expression is not a conspiracy. That is what we want to talk about, because we are beginning to gradually lose touch with the notion that political expression is not a conspiracy, because we know in the media, many of us in journalism have to admit to a certain degree of self-censorship these days. That alone ought to tell us something. We ought to be careful, because we, and that listeners know, and that our readers know, when we are self-censoring, or when there's something further to be examined. What is happening? Can we? What would you say the way forward is? What are you doing, as it were, to counter this alarming trend?
Sure. So the New York Times article is specifically about journalist Alexei Wood, whose trial started today, which is he was arrested along with 234 people during the J20 protest. January 20th is, of course, the date of Trump's inauguration. There were a number of protests that took place that day, including an a self-described anti-capitalist, anti-fascist march, where property damage did happen, but police just sort of followed the march and then eventually swept up and arrested 234 people, including journalists, including medics, including legal observers. And the prosecutors brought felony charges against them, which is very rare. And at one point, there was 8 felony charges, and they were facing up to 80 years in prison. But the judge has reduced it to just 6 felony charges, which carries 60 years in prison. So that is, at that point, not that much of a reduction.
But the prosecution is
having a really bizarre and frightening argument. It's essentially that if you go to a protest where an individual commits an act of vandalism, you're criminally liable for it. So they're charging all of the protesters with breaking the same window, even though the prosecutor admits that that's, you know, humanly impossible. Her argument is that it doesn't matter what the individuals did because the group is the criminal element. They also are charging these two journalists, Alexei Wood, whose trial starts today, and Aaron Cantu, whose trial starts later, probably sometime in December, along with the protesters. And the charges against them are the same as the protesters. It's you're at the scene of this event where this crime occurred, therefore you're guilty. And it really is a case of guilt by association. And if people think if they go to a protest, they can face 70 years in prison because somebody they've never met before in their life, you know, throws a rock at a Starbucks window, I mean, it's clear what's going to happen. People are going to not go out and protest. They're not going to, you know, engage in journalism. And that's a really frightening thing.
And, of course, all it would take was someone someone sent in tasked with breaking a window and thus getting thousands of people arrested. Easy.
Sure, and there was... Sure, and there was a police infiltrator. I mean, part of the case against the protesters rests on an undercover infiltrator who was at their organizing meetings. Project Veritas, the right-wing group, also infiltrated the protest organizing, and prosecutors have tried to enter into evidence things that the Project Veritas person found. And the prosecutors also tried to enter into evidence a video from the Oath Keepers, the right-wing militia, who has made it their mission to defend Donald Trump from free speech. So you're absolutely right. I mean, it's a really real threat, not only because of the history of police provocateurs, but because of the number of right-wing provocateurs that were present during this.
And here, out in the Wild Wild West, we have been entertained immensely by the Bundy trials, and it's astonishing to see how delicately our judicial system handles white male crime. The Bundys, of course, have been criminals from the get-go, believing as they do that only the sheriffs have any sort of authority out here. So their group of people consistently broken laws and not being charged. When one of the Bundys themselves has broken a law, then all the other people, their supporters and so forth, sometimes running up into the hundreds, have walked away from the situation. Whatever we want to call it, this new prosecutorial position, and these new laws seem to be applied very selectively. And if you have, as in the case of the Bundy trials, they for the most part walk away from it. That's yet another instance taken to its extremes. This is the silencing effect we've already seen. Are there any particular instances where these types of laws and the use of existing laws, Bill of Rights Defense Committee seen any other examples of this that you'd like people to know about?
Sure. One of the things we're most concerned with is there's been a proliferation of anti-protest bills at the state level. A lot of these bills do different things. One of them that's really popular that got a lot of attention is removing criminal liability for quote-unquote unintentionally running over protesters, yes, not running over all people, just protesters, so clearly singling out protesters as targets. A lot of them follow the logic, though, of the J20 prosecution, which is imposing criminal or civil liability on protesters collectively for the actions of a few. So there was one bill in Minnesota that, if it had passed, the city would have been allowed to sue all of the protesters for the cost of policing the demonstration if it was after the fact considered to be quote-unquote unlawful assembly. Arizona considered a bill that would have allowed the state to bring RICO charges, that is the racketeering statute used for organized crime against organizers of protests, if people at their protests, you know, engaged in an act of vandalism. If you organize a protest, it's open to the public. You don't know who's coming or why. You're not responsible for everything everyone does there. And it's very similar to the logic of the J20 case, which is they want to chill speech by imposing these forms of guilt by association and collective liability. So people say, hey, I don't know all the people who are in this crowd of several hundred or several thousand. If one of them breaks a brick, am I going to spend decades in prison? Am I going to be charged as a racketeer? Am I going to have to pay for the cost of the policing? And people will stay home, and it's what they want.
Extrapolating on from there, the picture becomes absurd and of course terrifying, nightmare scenario. But we are totally out of time now. Any final